Several years ago, I started hearing about a man making his way through the Amelia Earhart Fred Noonan disappearance investigation. What caught my attention wasn't just his research, it was the way his name kept coming up. From the moment I became involved in this story, I've been drawn to the lesser-known nuances that make up the towering mystery of Amelia Earhart. As I got to know people in the field, one name surfaced repeatedly. No matter the theory, no matter the angle, everyone seemed to be talking about the same guy. He's written books, published papers, and contributed to nearly every version of this story as it's been told over the years, including his appearance on Vanished Amelia Earhart, where he explored a well-known collection of bones discovered on Nikumaroro. That discovery, made by British colonial officer Gerald Gallagher, remains one of the most hotly debated pieces of evidence in this entire case. Were those bones the final remains of Amelia Earhart, a stranded castaway on a remote Pacific island? Or is the truth something else entirely? When I looked into his work, I immediately understood why he was so widely respected. He doesn't care about being right. He thinks bigger. His neutrality has allowed him to move freely across this story, collaborating with some of the most prominent figures in the investigation, people who sit in opposing camps defending starkly different theories. How does someone do that? How do you keep an open mind in a case that seems determined to pull you down an endless rabbit hole? Tonight, we find out. It's time to open your ears and your mind. We're making stops on Nikumaroro, Arona, and Buka by way of St. Paul, Minnesota. Welcome back to Chasing Earhart. This is Kenton Spading. And we're live. Welcome, Kenton. Thank you so much for doing this. Your debut. Welcome to the show.
You're most welcome, Chris. I'm honored to be on the show. And I got to say, I frequently, when I'm emailing Amelia Earhart researchers, I'll send them a link to one of your podcasts from the show, right? Like, hey, you need to listen to this if you want to really know that story right or whatever. So valuable resource that way. Plus, your rabbit hole book is a desk reference for me. I'm constantly going to that and looking up something. So, for example, if you really want to kind of know what Richard Jantz thought about the Nikumaroro bones, you really got to go to your rabbit book to find that out, you know? So thank you.
Oh, well. Coming from you, that's a huge honor. Thank you. I will say this as a disclaimer here, because I think it's important to have one at the top of this episode. I'm going to say right at the top of the conversation tonight, this is going to be one for the nerds, the folks that are really, really ingrained in this. If you followed the castaway hypothesis, especially tonight, I think is your night. At the risk of oversimplification, I'm just going to assume that if you're listening to this and you're this far into the show, you'll know the names and the points of interest and reference that we'll be discussing tonight. Check the show's notes if you need to be brought up to speed before you dive in. Okay, here we go, sir. Let's start from the beginning. Pre-Earhart, give us a snapshot of your education, your professional background as we get into this tonight.
Okay. When I got out of high school, I didn't know what I wanted to do. So I took 6 years to work in the construction industry, operating some heavy equipment and buildings and things like that. When I got to be 24 years old, I knew I wanted to be an engineer. So I went to college, got my civil engineering degree, graduated in 1979, and I've been working for the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers since then as a civilian engineer in water resources type endeavors. I started to get involved with Earhart in about 1989, which grew out of a kind of an interest that my father had. My father always had an interest in historical mysteries.
Yeah.
The Egyptian pyramids, Atlantis, whatever. And he had some interest in Earhart as well. And I kind of caught that bug. And so here I am.
Yeah, here you are. Well, the second half of that two-part question is, and you touched on it a little bit, the connection to your father. Can you remember the first time you heard about the Earhart case in more than just a passing sort of cursory way? Did you, the first time you sort of got into this?
I can. The Tiger Organization had an expedition to Nikumaroro in 1989. It was either their first or second expedition there. I forget which number. And my local newspaper here on the Sunday paper, had a headline on one of the sections about a gentleman from Minnesota who was on that expedition. And I read that article and I thought, wow, that's really interesting, right? I didn't realize there was a whole big Earhart mystery out there, you know?
Yeah.
For Matt Mather, I didn't even really know that much about Amelia Earhart, but I thought, wow, if that guy only lives an hour from me, I'm going to go meet him. So I called him up. In those days, you had to call an operator and get his phone number. And we ended up having dinner and talked into the evening about it. And he hooked me on it and convinced me to join Tiger. So I joined Tiger. And then Tiger offered an aviation archaeology course. So I took that course, a week-long course. Through that, I met Rick Gillespie, the executive director of Tiger. Actually, my first work with Tiger wasn't with Earhart. I went on four expeditions with Rick Gillespie to Newfoundland looking for the white bird. And on two of those expeditions, this gentleman from Minnesota was with me. Verl Finnelson was his name. A few years went by, and they're like, "Well, we're going to go back to Nikumaro now for Nikumaro 3, 1997." And I got picked to be on the team, and here I am.
Well, you've mentioned Nikumaro, Canton. You've been there once, Nikumaro twice. You're one of the few people that have had that precious experience. What is it like when you get off the boats and you step foot onto those islands with the weight of this case sort of on your mind and what you're trying to do there?
It's overwhelming when you first get there because you want to look everywhere, right? But the island's 4.5 miles long, half 1.5 to 2 miles wide, and you realize that you've only got a week to 10 days that you're there and you got to focus on something. So it's a feeling of kind of awe, and your mind races to let's get busy and see how much we can get done while we're here.
Okay, so this is one of those moments that I referenced early at the top of the conversation. Let's talk about your discovery and the rediscovery of the Hoodless Report in the UK. Now, D.W. Hoodless, if you don't know who he is, he's very significant to the Earhart case, to the Nikumaro hypothesis in particular. If you want to give a quick snapshot of who Hoodless really was and his importance, and then talk a little bit about the discovery of that report in the UK, talk about that moment and its significance sort of in your career, because that happened sort of early in your career in the Earhart case.
It did. So in kind of the 1996, 97 time frame, another Tiger member had stumbled onto a group of telegrams in the archives at Tarawa on Tarawa Island that included some telegrams from a British colonial officer named Gerald Gallagher, who was on Nikumaro Island, Gardner Island at that time, saying, "Hey, I found a skeleton on the island." But it was only snapshots of telegrams. It wasn't the whole story, and the Hoodless report wasn't there. It just was this reference to a skeleton that he had found. And that's all we had. Beginning in kind of that 96, 97 time frame, I launched an effort. This is pre-internet now. An effort to find more about that. And I thought, well, the British are meticulous record keepers. There's going to be more to this somewhere, right? In some archive somewhere. So I started writing letters to various archives around the world. I had heard at first that the records might be in New Zealand. I wrote a letter. In those days, you couldn't, it was emailing people was difficult, but I wrote a letter. That didn't go anywhere. I ended up writing a letter to the archive back in Tarawa. I wrote a letter to Britain. And after a couple of years of that, one day I got a letter from somebody in New Zealand, one of the archivists in New Zealand, who said, "Hey, I stumbled onto this inquiry you gave us a while ago. And those records you're looking for are in the United Kingdom in a place called Hanslope, England," which is kind of their CIA base, like here would be Langley over there. It's called Hanslope. And that's where the records are. So I fired off a letter to them, to the archivist there. And in due course, I got a letter back saying, "Yep, we have some records here. We don't see what you're looking for." So a little more time went by, and I dug up some more clues about specifically what I was looking for. I wrote to them again. And this time they said, "Yeah, we found it. Here's a couple of snapshot pages, but if you want everything else, you got to come here." So in November of 1998, Rick Gillespie and I flew to England and got into Hanslope and came back with hundreds and hundreds of pages of photocopies from the archives, including the Hoodless report.
Jeez. When you find something like that, that has been, it's been in play for some time, but it's sort of, it's been out of touch, and no one's been able to find it or locate it. And as you mentioned, you go through this process, you write these letters, you just wait for some time. And then all of a sudden, one day it picks up, and now it's kind of, it leads to the discovery of something like that. Do you think ultimately, I mean, we're sort of going beyond the grail here, but do you think ultimately that's how a case like this gets solved? Just a discovery of something previously thought to not exist that now exists. And it's not maybe sexy, but it's maybe how this case is going to be cracked wide open. I mean, do you think that's a possibility?
It is a possibility, and I do believe that to be true. There's been numerous cases of that actually in the Earhart saga so far. the Chatter Report comes to mind, right? The gentleman that
Yes.
wrote the report from Lake Lugini about her ship, which was found in Alaska, of all places, just by happenstance, more or less. Or did they find it in San Francisco? I forget. It was one of those two. Horless Report's an example of that. So, yes, exactly. And
Yeah.
it just requires diligence and searching to include researching the null hypothesis, which we'll get into later in the talk here. Back to when you find something like that, it's what I call being kissed by discovery. So when you get that letter in the mail or an email, nowadays it's an email usually from something, and it's like, wow, it's kind of a chill goes through you, and it's like being kissed by discovery,
Yeah, it's a beautiful way to say it. That's very poignant. Listen, I can't let the conversation tonight go by without talking about Amelia Earhart's Shoes. That is one of my favorite books. That links you with Dr. Tom King, who I have a lot of respect for and who was the very first guest who ever sat down with me on the show. He's been on the show multiple times, taken part on multiple projects with him. Lots of respect. Now it's been some time since that book is released. What are your takeaways from that book now in retrospect, now that it's out there and it's been consumed, and I'm sure you've gotten lots of emails on it and opinions. What are your takeaways from that book?
First of all, I want to thank Tom King publicly for having the faith in me to be a co-author on that book. There were two other co-authors, but Tom and I did a majority of the work on it. So just an honor to work with Tom on that book. But Tom had the foresight to guide me during when we were writing the book to not say the mystery was solved or to not say that we knew the answers. So to anyone listening out there, the book doesn't do that like a lot of Earhart books do. It doesn't say that. It basically is kind of like the rabbit book in a way, in that I've always told people the Shoes book is a discussion of rabbit holes, right? You chase down this hole, ends up being a dead end. This one isn't a dead end. And each chapter kind of talks about that and gives you a history really of the search up till that point, which was about 2000. I think the second edition came out in 2004, maybe. So it's just been a pleasure to work on it, and I still reference it to this day. I was looking up something in there the other day for Rick Pettigrew in relation to the Tarot project that he's working on, who I know you just interviewed him, but.
Gosh, Nick Amororo is a monster. In preparing for this tonight and kind of this long time coming discussion that we're going to be having, I wanted to try to hit this as broad as I can, and then we'll go in into the fine details. The idea of Castaway. I know it's been a long time. I know it's been around for a long time. The hypothesis has certainly evolved over the course of the last several decades. What is it about that hypothesis for you that makes it compelling? That's where your career began. That's where you spent the majority of the work in your career. Why do you keep coming back to Nick Amororo? What is it about it for you?
Yes. When you interviewed me in, I believe it was 2019 for the Rabbit Hole book, and anyone who wants to re look back and read that, you'll see that in that interview, I advocate for the Nick Amororo hypothesis. In fact, I think I even went so far in there as to say that I thought it was more likely than maybe crashed and sank, right?
Yeah, that's
So
right.
that was in the spring of 2019 when you interviewed me for that. That year ended up being a pivotal year for me. So already by that time, John Kada, excellent researcher, by the way, Earhart people, look up the Ghost of Gardner Island
Oh,
website.
yes.
That
Shout out to John
John,
Cada. He will be on the
yeah.
show hopefully
Yeah,
soon.
I just talked to John this morning. He's looking forward to talking to you. So a year before that, in 2018, he had proved that the sextant box that Gallagher found wasn't Earhart related. So that was a year before you interviewed me in 2019. And already I was kind of like, that was the first crack in the dam, kind of like, oh, that big piece of evidence went away. Well, then by the fall of 2019, John published on his website a report on the work that Tom Palshaw had done on the aircraft aluminum artifact, Artifact 22V1. So that was in the fall of 2019, about 4 or 5 months after you interviewed me, and I read that and I saw, oh my gosh. He said that piece of aluminum, I don't think it's from Earhart now, right? It sure looked like it was from the C-47 that crashed on Sydney Island. So by the end of 2019, I'm like, oh wow, that's interesting. Well, then parallel with that, Dr. Richard Jantz in February of 2018 had published his paper saying, it looks like those bones that were found on Nick Morrow Island and that Hoodless looked at are maybe Amelia Earhart's bones, right? So parallel with that, with the 22V1 looking like it's in C-47, Tom King called me. He said, I know you have data on the Norwich City sailors. And he said, I just got done reading Jantz's paper, and he says in there, We need to look at the Norwich City Sailors, is basically what he said in his paper. And he even said that in the interview that Jantz did with you in your book.
Yeah, that's right.
He says Norwich City Sailors are a possibility. And really, I think almost a direct quote was, we need to look into that, you know? So Tom said, you've got data on the Norwich City Sailors. You got to publish that. You got to get that on the street. So by early January, actually, of 2019, I'd published that paper with Tom King's help. Joe Cerniglia helped me too. And so by the time we rolled along into 2019 and getting into 2020, I started to see that the Nicomoro hypothesis was starting to be chipped away at the evidence. The evidence was starting to be chipped away. The sextant box had gone away.
Yeah.
2V1 was looking less likely. Now, having said that, I got to say that Rick Gillespie is going to publish a paper in the next few months about 2V1 that claims it's maybe still is Earhart's. But what I've seen, I think it likely is not.
Yeah.
So the sextant box went away, 2V2 went away, and then I started digging more into the bones, the Norwich City sailors, and when I discovered the sailor Sallee
Riggy, yeah.
Rigi was the same height as the Nicomoro bones, you know, within a reasonable estimate, I just started thinking, wow, I think we need to start looking at what's known as the null hypothesis. In fact, Tom King specifically says that in the introduction to my 2019 paper on Sallee Rigi. He says this is the null hypothesis and we need to look at it further.
Yeah.
And then kind of parallel with that, I've been looking more at crashed and sank, and the crashed and sank hypothesis is becoming more and more intriguing to me. I've been in touch recently with Dave Jordan of Nauticos. We've traded a few emails. Him and I are planning to do some correlate on some research related to that. So
Yeah.
that's kind of where I'm at. I've backed off being fully bought into Nicomoro to being, I'm not denying Nicomoro hypothesis. I'm not saying Earhart wasn't there,
Right.
but I'm saying we need to look at this a little bit more.
Okay, so let's talk about that for a moment because I think that's an interesting observation, and I think there's an interesting lesson there that people who are listening to this should probably take away, and that is looking at a theory, an idea, a hypothesis, things not maybe turning out for that hypothesis in support of that hypothesis, looking at something like that, and then knowing when to say, hey, maybe this isn't the story here. Maybe there's something more to something else that's going on. I feel like the case is so big and there's so many ideas. It's just such a large monster of a case that to sort of funnel everything into one idea in any direction, I think could be bad. It could sort of give you tunnel vision, and that can be bad for the case. You can't see the forest for the trees. We're about to get into several other areas of the case here, and people will obviously will learn that you have touched a lot of different areas and spoken with a lot of folks. How important is that kind of a mindset when you're looking at a case like this?
It's very important. Humans tend to get caught up in confirmation bias. We like a story, it's sexy, it's this, it's that. And then we start attributing so-called evidence to support that without looking at other possibilities. And it really hinders investigations. Time and effort is spent on something that isn't prudent, and you end up not getting to the real truth. And it's equally important to investigate evidence that you think supports your theory, but it's also equally important to look at the try to prove that evidence doesn't fit your hypothesis, which is one of the things I've been doing with the Norwich City sailors and the castaway bone studies I've been doing. I think it slows down research if you get too focused on one idea.
Yeah. Absolutely. Well, on the flip side of that, let me just ask you, if the bones found in 1940 did belong to a Norwich City sailor, what does that do for the Earhart mystery as a whole? What does that do for Castaway? Does that sort of put a nail in the coffin for that? Or is it still possible that we could have the bones out of play and Earhart still ending up on Nicomororo?
Well, without actually finding the bones, we won't be able to
Right.
say one way or the
Right.
other, getting them in or out of play. But let's say we get to where it's equally likely, if not more likely, that the bones are from a Norwich City sailor than they were from Earhart. It still doesn't discount Earhart as being there. You still have a body of evidence, for example, the post-lost radio messages,
Yes.
maybe to a lesser extent, the Pan Am direction finding vectors. You still have some things that were found on the island that suggest an Earhart connection, like the freckle cream jar and the zipper pull that seems to be a female type zipper pull and some things like that. So it doesn't discount the Earhart theory, but it begins to chip away at it a little bit more.
Okay, there is a hypothesis out there that we've talked about on the show before a couple of times, and the gentleman who has sort of birthed that hypothesis and been champion of that, his name is Tom Maxwell, and he has been looking at this object in the Arona Lagoon for quite some time now. And I know you've spoken with Tom. I know you've looked into that a little bit, and I know that that is one of the ongoing projects that you are interested in. For the listeners who are not familiar with Maxwell's idea, can you talk a little bit about that idea and what is compelling to you about this object that he feels might be Earhart's?
Yeah, Tom Maxwell, myself, and Lou Tolman. For those that aren't familiar with Lou, he's an excellent researcher who was on the 2017 expedition to Nicomoro. That's where I met Lou. The three of us have actually formed a team. We are the Orono slash Hall. It used to be Hall Island, Orono slash Hall Island team, and we're looking at what's known as the Orono object. So Tom was on nearby Canton Island in the 1970s as part of the ballistic missile testing that was being done. They'd launch ballistic missiles from California. They'd splash down in that island area, and then they'd track kind of where they were and where they went. Tom was assigned to that mission and was out on that island. And he says that one day, one of the helicopter pilots came back from Orna, which is where they had one of the tracking towers for the missiles. And he said, "You know, I was flying over the lagoon there today, and I looked down and I saw an airplane under the water in the lagoon." So that always stuck in Tom's mind. He just put it away in his back of his memory bank, you know, that that had happened. And then years later, you know, up until maybe, I don't know, 10 or so years ago, he heard about the Earhart mystery and what Tiger was doing at Nicomoro, and he contacted Tom King and said, "Hey, I got this other theory about, I'm going to call it Hall Island, by the way, just because that's what it was at the time." And Tom King contacted me and said, "I think you need to talk to this guy," because at that time I was chairing the Amelia Earhart Symposium every year in Eugene, Oregon. And he said, "You need to have him be one of your speakers." Well, long story short is I met Tom Maxwell and we talked some more, and it always intrigued me. Hall Island always intrigued me because there was a colonial officer there when Earhart disappeared. There was a British colonial officer there. They had a radio there, and I always thought that Earhart probably knew that, and if she got lost, might try to make a try to get to Hall, right? But I knew that if the airplane crashed anywhere near the colonial island, they would know that, and that wouldn't have went unnoticed. And by the way, the radio was broken when Earhart was flying there, so I said to him, "You got to show me where on Hall you think this object is." Well, he said, "It's way on the other end of the island, like 4.5 miles away from where the colonial village was." So then I thought, well, you have a possibility of the Earhart crash landing, and she would try to crash land in a lagoon, maybe because of the still water as opposed to the ocean. Crash land in a lagoon there, 4 miles away from the colonial office. They wouldn't have heard that. Airplane sinks. Maybe they get trapped in the airplane and they drown, or however that might happen. So there were some aspects of it, of the hypothesis, that I couldn't discount. And I said, "Well, Tom, we got to get some high resolution satellite photos of the island, of the lagoon, and just see if we can see something." And we have obtained that photograph now. And we're in the process right now of engaging some photogrammetrists, some satellite photo experts, to take a look at that to see. So that's where that's at right now.
All right, stay tuned for that. We will have updates on that as that project progresses. I did want to ask you, we have several more topics we're going to try to hit on tonight, but I did want to ask you, and I couldn't let you get away tonight without talking about the elephant in the room, in my opinion, which is the wreck site out at Buka and Bill Snavely, Project Blue Angel. You have also consulted heavily. We've dropped your name several times in prior episodes. As somebody who has consulted with Bill Snavely, you've talked at length with him now. What is your take? We're getting ready to mount this expedition, hopefully spring, summer of this year. We're really trying to get out there. What are your thoughts on Buka? Is it possible?
It is possible. I did a lot of research into the hypothesis a couple of years ago, and I got interested enough that I got on an airplane and flew to the East Coast. I live in Minnesota to spend the day with Bill. You know, I wanted to sit down with this guy and have him walk me through the hypothesis. And if you take Earhart's radio calls and you assume for a minute that a lot of times where it says Earhart's call signs calling Itasca, you assume that that was the radio operator typing that in there, and that Earhart wasn't saying that, which I think is pretty well accepted. and you start reversing those radio call-outs to have Earhart turning around and flying back toward Buka. Now she's trying to call Buka, not the Itasca. I can't discount it. It starts to make some sense. And when you throw into that the wind report from, for example, Chatter report we just talked about, right? Where you go, we had a report of 23 knot winds. Now, granted, that was at sea level and not aloft, but and even some of the Itasca reports discuss strong, some winds and so on. So I don't know. It sure seems possible to me. Yeah.
Well, we'll find out. That's for
And
sure.
not only that, but we need to find out what that airplane is in any case, right?
Absolutely.
It's either Earhart or World War II, and this deserves to be solved. Somebody, some family lost somebody, right?
I'm with you 100%. That's why we're doing it. That's why we're there. And we're going to get an answer one way or another, which is exciting. And I think a lot of answers are going to come to light in the next, several months to the next year. It's just the wheels of this case move very, very slowly. As we're talking about stuff tonight, I did want to ask you, and it's a sort of a bigger picture question. There'll be probably a couple of more of these before we get out of here. But I did want to ask you about just the sheer volume of Earhart theory out there. This case is, it's a very old case. A lot of people would agree that we don't have much more information now than we did on July 3rd of 1937, day after they disappeared. We're kind of, it's a lot of guesswork, a lot of theory, a lot of hypothesis, but not a whole lot of factual data. You're sort of bouncing around this case. You're talking to a lot of different folks, which I think is the right way to go. It's a collaborative attitude. How do you balance skepticism with, having this open mind that you have that I think a lot of people can sort of look at and maybe take something from?
A thought that I hold on to is as we investigate each hypothesis, so let's say Hall Island, Buka, crashed and sank, Nikumaroro is just a few examples. If we start to chip away at those, for example, at Buka, we're going to know at Buka, right? There's an airplane there, yay or nay, right? And if it's nay, then guess what? That funding or that interest can then go to one of the other ones, So as you kind of knock down the different dominoes, you can eventually get down to where maybe we can get more focused instead of having $1 million going out to four different things. We can
Agreed.
kind of get it narrowed down, and that's my hope.
Like I said, you've been doing this a long time. What's been the biggest challenge, your biggest frustration over the years? Is there anything that sticks out to you that's been the most frustrating when it comes to this case?
The most frustrating for me is folks who, from time to time, claim they know the answer to the mystery. Or even within a particular hypothesis, they'll claim they know some answer. I'll give two examples. Number one, we don't know what happened to Amelia Earhart. So news to everyone, we don't know what happened to Amelia Earhart, right? And if we dig within just a particular hypothesis, I'll take the Nikumaro hypothesis for an example. We don't know where on Nikumaro Island Gallagher found the bones. We don't know the answer to that. But there's a lot of people out there who will say, no, he found the bones at what's known as the Seven Site. In fact, that's oftentimes quoted as the quote, castaway site. And we don't know that. That's what frustrates me is when we don't know something scientifically, the scientific method doesn't prove something yet. It's quoted as fact, which creates more Earhart myths. To my opinion, the folks who claim that we know where Gallagher found the bones have created a myth. He might have found the bones at the Seven Site. He might have. I'm not saying he didn't, but we don't know that. That's what frustrates me.
I'm going to ask you a question that my son wanted me to ask you, actually. We were talking about this a few nights ago, and he actually has shown interest in some aspects of Nikumaroro, and he came up with a cool question. I never thought about this. So I'm going to ask you, because you've been talking about Gallagher, if you could go back in time to 1940 and stand next to Gerald Gallagher as he found the bones, what do you do differently? How do you direct that?
I would have more accurately noted where they were found. I wouldn't have said the southeast end of the island, which is what he said. I would have been more specific, so many feet or yards or something from a known landmark. So I would have definitely said where they were found. I would have been more descriptive in how and where the artifacts, the associated artifacts, were found. Now, he was limited in his ability to do that when he was on Nikumaroro because he had to rely on telegrams, which are by their nature short and clipped. But he spent quite a bit of time in Fiji with the bones, what we call the bones file, with actually with the bones after they'd been shipped there. He had plenty of time to write memorandums for the record and put them into the file and everything. So those two things, I would have made it clear where I found the bones on the island And then I would have documented more where I actually found the artifacts. For example, I think the sextant box, which, okay, the sextant box wasn't Earhart's, but I'm not convinced that it was found where the bones were. I think it might have been found. If you read carefully, read his telegrams carefully, it's kind of implied that maybe it was found somewhere else, you know?
As you're talking, I'm thinking about this, and this might be a broader, bigger picture question, but if the Norwich City sailor hypothesis is correct, it would mean that obviously forensic anthropology misidentified the castaways' remains for decades. What does that say about the limitations of historical forensic methods as we know them, and how we can really use them to re-examine past cases like this, not only Earhart, but just in general? I mean, the limitations of forensics at that time. Jantz talked about it on our very own show way back when. The limitations were apparent, and apparently it reflects.
Well, let's talk about Hoodless to begin with, I guess. In Hoodless's examination, he, with the technology he had at the time, he came up with a pretty accurate description of the castaway's height, and he said it was a stocky European or half-caste, I believe was the words. In your rabbit hole book, Jantz even acknowledges in there that if it had been a Norwich City sailor, that would match. You know, that would make sense. They're short. In fact, the paper the little note I sent you the other day, you know, they're about 5'6" is the average height of a male in Yemen, and they're short and stocky. Were you alluding to that there was a limitation to what Hoodless did? Because Hoodless may have gotten it right. Right.
Well, and I guess, yeah, and I guess just more questions than answers, right? I feel like that leads me to not to question his credibility, but his credibility has been sort of dragged through the mud over this whole thing. What do you think? I mean, you've looked at this so extensively. I mean, was he qualified to make the calls that he made on that report? You know, was he the guy that you'd want to have in that situation? Or did he do the best that he could with what he had?
Yeah, well, he definitely did the best that he could with what he had, right? He's in Fiji, he's on a remote island. Was there somebody in maybe the UK, you know, at Cambridge University, or somebody who had done a lot of this kind of work in Egypt, you know? And you know, there was a lot of Brits that were around the world doing, you know, quote unquote, the archaeology of the time, right? Was there somebody better qualified? There definitely was, but I think he did as good as he could at the time, and Jantz has even kind of alluded to that. You know, he measured the skull orbit width down to a tenth of a millimeter, right? I mean, you know, it just sounds like he was trying pretty hard, you know?
And I guess I just wonder if, you know, the forensic science at the time, you know, was it inherently flawed, you know, or was it just constrained, you know, by his limitations and what he had available to him. You know, I often wonder, could this have been, you know, the sum of a lot of little things, you know, in this direction, you know, when it comes to the misidentification of these bones, the loss of the bones, you know, just all the whole picture is just you know, it's kind of a mess.
To clarify there, though, I'm not a proponent of them having been misidentified, right? We don't know. I'm not saying that he identified them as being short European or half caste. I'm not saying that he got that right. He very well could have got that wrong, but we just don't know. I think he did the best that he could, and I know there are people out there who say that he misidentified them and that in fact that was Amelia Earhart. We don't know that.
Gosh, where do we go from here, Kenton? You know, there are a lot of active investigations going on right now. There's, you know, an interesting wreck site they're trying to re-find over in East New Britain. That documentary that just came out on the Discovery Channel that Jen Taylor hosted not too long ago covers that. You've got this wreck site in Buka. You've got some potential targets out near Howland and Baker. You've got a lot of course, Japanese capture is still going strong behind the scenes. They're working on a lot of stuff there, overturning a lot of stones. Where do you see this case going? Where do you think, if you're directing this thing all around, where do you think this ship should steer next as far as the case as a whole on the disappearance side of things?
Yeah, if I was the kind of the grand master of the, let's say, four or so hypotheses that are out there that are some form or another planning expeditions, like there's an expedition planned for Buka, another one for Niku, Nauticos, and Deep Sea Vision. We haven't even talked about Tony Romeo yet. You know, are planning to go back out there again. But if I had to put it all that together, I would knock out Buka first. Let's go yay nay on Buka, right? That's where I would go first. Crashed and sank. I really am been intrigued by the work that Jen Taylor did on that, combined with the things that Deep Sea Vision has done and that Nauticos has done, particularly some of the radio work that Nauticos did. There's amazing radio work they did on that.
It is.
I would go back there second, I guess, to Crash and Sank. Having said that, in the longer vision of things, I believe that someday the entire bottom of the ocean will be mapped.
I agree with that. That's not the first time that idea has been floated on this,
Yeah.
no pun intended.
So one theory is that you don't spend a few more millions and millions of dollars looking around Holland or Northwest Holland. You just wait for the
You
day,
just wait it out.
a decade from now, I don't know when it'll be, when the whole ocean's mapped, like the whole world surface is mapped, and you're probably gonna know, right? So
The one bigger picture question I wanted to ask you, and I've asked this question a few times on the show, but I think for you it's poignant one to ask. Again, you're so ingrained in this. We'll have links to everything in the show's notes. People will see how deep you run in this case. I do want to ask, and I think I feel like I have to ask, if we never find out what happened to Earhart and Noonan, if we never discover the final resting place of this Electra, if we don't get any answers beyond what we've got now, are you okay with not knowing?
I am. The journey is so fun and interesting. There's almost a piece of me that doesn't want the journey to end, right? It's so, and not truly, but it's just the journey itself is worth it. So if we don't get a resolution, so be it.
Final question of the night. Talk to me about the legacy in 2025. One doesn't get involved in a case like this without caring about the subjects of that case. Can you talk a little bit about Earhart's legacy, what it means to you personally? Why are you doing this after all this time? I mean, it's obviously for a reason. I'd love to hear it.
I am interested in her legacy for women's rights, advocating for women's rights more than I am at her as an aviator. Women didn't have the right to vote in 1921, right? So Earhart had a period in her life where she couldn't vote, right, in this country. And one of the really famous quotes was one of the, she used to go around to colleges lecturing at various colleges on women's rights, One of the colleges that she was at, they were banning her from speaking there because the president of the university said, if we allow her to talk here, then all the women in our college will get the idea that they don't need to get married and have a husband. And then none of the guys here will be able to get married, right? Or something to that effect, right? Like, right? To her credit, she'd go to those colleges and go, hey, look, gals, you can have a career, you can have a life, which just wasn't a thing for lots of women in the period before World War II or even a little after, That's what excites me about her is her being gone and missing overshadows that. It brings it to light to some degree because there's a lot of books now about Earhart that we wouldn't have had if she hadn't got lost. But boy, once we could solve the mystery, I think that part of her life could really bloom.
Well, you and I are right there with that.
And the first report that I published on this, which people can find on academia.edu, they just type in my name, they'll find the report. I collaborated on that report with Richard Jantz. So I want to do a shout out to Richard Jantz. He published what you could call the defining paper so far on the Castaway Bones, the 2018 paper that he published. But yet he's open to other hypotheses to the extent that this world famous, guy within the bones community anyway, maybe not world famous, but within the bones community, collaborated with me on that report. And now I'm writing a third report that he's helping me with, which I sent a copy of you to you a couple of days ago. And
Yeah, that's right.
I want to touch on that a little bit.
Okay.
The Norwich City sailor, Sahli Rahghi, was 5'6". 5'6" is approximately the height of the castaway. So we got a match there. Earhart was 5'7". She matches as well. So we're even there. But Jantz was able to measure the length of Earhart's upper and lower arms, and her upper leg bone. And then from those measurements, he was able to match them pretty close to the castaway bone's lengths. So Jantz had a match there. Okay, so now that makes Earhart a really good candidate for the castaway bones. About a year ago, I contacted Richard and I said, I want to take my 2019 paper to another level. Can you help me? And he said, yeah. He said, you need to find a proxy population because we don't have those bone measurements for Yemen, but find another population that has the average height of Yemen's, which I think Mexicans do. He said, go down that route. So I dug into that. I found a Mexican study. I did the regression equations, and I now have estimates for someone who's 5'6" for those bone lengths, and those bone lengths match the castaway's bone lengths. Now, the problem is that I now have to prove that a Mexican population is a proxy for a Yemen population. And
Got
Vance has given me some guidance on how to do that. I need to get some radiuses of the different bones and so on. I'm sorry, ratios. I'm not at where I need to be yet, but I'm working on it.
So I know we've covered a lot tonight. As we wrap up and get out of here, or before we wrap up and get out of here, just real quickly, where can folks find your work online? You just mentioned your report with Jantz. We'll have that linked in the show notes, but where can folks find, should they just Google you? What's the best way to get a hold of some of the stuff you've done?
Yeah, www.academia.edu.
Okay.
That's where my stuff's at. And once you're there, if you just in the search box type in my name, Kenton Spading, my page will pop up. And the very first hit on the page is the Amelia Earhart Report.
Okay. We will link that in the show's notes for tonight. Kenton, I don't think this will be the last time we sit down for the show, but it was a hell of a first time. Thank you so much, sir. I appreciate you.
Thank you.
This is Chris Williamson, and thank you for listening to this episode of Chasing Earhart. We hope you've enjoyed the show. Please visit us on social media, where we post each new episode as it airs, news, show information, and group discussion. Go to facebook.com/ChasingEarhart, and on Twitter and Instagram, search the handle @ChasingEarhart. Reviews are crucial to the show. If you enjoyed this episode, please head to Apple Podcasts to rate us and leave us a review. It really does help get the word out. Your editor and host for Chasing Earhart is me, Chris Williamson. The show is produced by my wife, Vanessa Williamson, with music by Dane Jarrus Schmidt. The opinions on Chasing Earhart are those of the individual guests and may not reflect those of Madhouse Films Incorporated. Madhouse Films Incorporated is not affiliated with the films or clips referred to herein. All clips and audio used in the podcast are the intellectual property of their respective copyright holders. They are included here for the purposes of historical entertainment and education, and no infringement is ever intended. Chasing Earhart is an exclusive trademark of Madhouse Films Incorporated and may not be used without the express written consent of Madhouse Films Incorporated. All rights reserved. Chasing Earhart is a Madhouse Films production. All rights reserved.